It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll find out about the November gale that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald 40 years ago.
First, it's Veterans Day, where the nation celebrates and honors service members around the country and focuses attention on services they might need.
Two Democratic lawmakers in Wisconsin are seeking support for a legislative proposal to assist veterans and their families when they need mental health services. And in a recent opinion piece, they lay out the case for why it's needed and what would change.
Joining us now is John Erpenbach. He's a Democratic state senator from Middleton. Senator Erpenbach, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
So you're trying to fill a gap here. Where is the mental health care system falling short for veterans here in Wisconsin?
Well, what goes on is when a veteran applies for mental health services, the VA, you know, if it's something that's immediate and they're in a lot of trouble, they'll get mental health services right away. But there could be a two-week gap to a four-week gap to a couple of months before other situations are resolved. So the idea is we have a needy veterans fund here in the state of Wisconsin, and we don't spend all the money in the fund by any means. So the idea is just to take some of that money, and the county service officers can administer it and just essentially buy gap coverage, for lack of a better term, for veterans seeking mental health services until the VA basically gets them signed up with whatever it is they have to do.
So in a life or death case, it sounds like you're saying the VA can make that appointment. But what kind of things are falling into that gap, a service that might be needed on an urgent basis, but it has that wait?
It's hard to say only because everybody's different. I mean, all individuals are different when it comes to mental health services. And it just could be, look, I'm under a lot of stress, or it could be, look, I'm thinking about taking my life, or I want to take my life, whatever the case may be. Those cases would be addressed immediately. But again, if the decision is made, okay, we think you're okay. Yes, you need mental health services, but we think you're going to be okay until we can make it available to you. That's where the Needy Veterans Fund would come into play. And what Representative Gordon Hems and I are proposing is just let's take some of that money and at least get them on the road to mental health recovery by providing some gap insurance until the VA can get them to where they need to be.
So on a practical level, for a veteran in this situation, what would the state do for them with this using that money, as you mentioned, for the Needy Veterans Program?
Well, what would happen is each county has a county service officer, and the veteran would go to that county service officer, and the county service officer has the ability to basically waive any sort of income eligibility issues or anything else like that and direct them to the services right away, and then take the money out of the Needy Veterans Fund to pay for it. It's a very simple process to do. The county service officers do a great job in servicing the veterans that they work with, but this would just be something else that they would be able to do until the VA, again, got veterans lined up with the services that they needed.
And this would connect them with a mental health care provider, not with the VA, somebody in a private system or somebody with the county?
It would be somebody within the private system, but just whoever is available. And based on the needs of what the veteran is looking for at that particular point in time. There are those who provide mental health services, deal with a wide range of all sorts of different types of mental health issues. And so it would depend on if it's somebody working for the state or somebody in the private sector. If that individual needs someone in the private sector based on their expertise, that's where they go.
Talking to State Senator John Erpenbach about legislation he is sponsoring, authoring, aimed at providing mental health care in a more timely manner for veterans here in Wisconsin. Now, this, as you mentioned, it would use funding from the Needy Veterans Program. Can you just tell us a little bit about that program and what it does without this legislation in place?
Sure. The program, basically, there's a veteran in need of something that would qualify for within that program, and it could be all sorts of different types of things. They go to the county service officers, and they work with the county services officers on that. And it's a pot of money that it's about $900,000 a year that the Veterans Fund, Needy Veterans Fund, gets. And I think they spend, on average, a little over $200,000 to $250,000 a year. So there's a lot of money left over. And so it's not like we would have to put more money into this fund because it's not needed. Needy Veterans Fund has been... Well, I don't know how long. It's a great question. I don't know how long it's actually been in operation, but I know it's been there for a long time, and it's a really good program for veterans in need. It really is.
Is this something you see as a temporary stopgap measure? I mean, the VA, its problems are no secret. They've been all over the press here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Are you hoping that ultimately the VA can solve this problem, fill this gap, and Wisconsin wouldn't need to fill it in anymore?
Well, I would think it would be great if they could, but at the same time, the VA is just so big. And there are situations that arise with the veterans that as quick as the VA and those who work at the VA want to respond to these situations, they just simply can't. And so, again, if obviously it's an emergency situation, that's one thing. But many times it's not. But that doesn't mean that the mental health services aren't justified nonetheless. So it's not really so much a matter of the VA trying to turn around something as it is the state of Wisconsin being able to step up with this fund and say, look, we can get you covered between now and the time that the VA can get the services up and running for you.
I know this legislation is just off the drawing board now, but have you heard response from your colleagues, especially from your Republican colleagues in the legislature?
Yeah, I think we actually have a couple of Republicans in the Assembly that have signed on, but the legislation itself is up and running, but this is something that Representative Hintz and I introduced when we were on the Finance Committee. Back in May, I believe it was, and we brought it up for a vote. It was either in April or May. Brought it up for a vote, and the Republicans on the Finance Committee at that time said it was a good idea, but they voted it down nonetheless.
Do you think this is something that you have a hope for getting bipartisan support for?
Yeah, I certainly would hope so. I see no reason why we couldn't. It's a really good idea, and it's a situation where the Republicans and Democrats, we all know that there's a need out there for mental health services for everybody, but especially veterans. And if a veteran is going to go have the ability, or anybody for that matter, but have the ability to say, look, I need some help with some things, and the VA will be there for them, but they can't be there for them today, the state of Wisconsin has to. And there's no reason in the world why we should.
Senator Erpenbach, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, guys. Take care.
That was Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach. He joined us to talk about expanding access to mental health services for veterans in Wisconsin. The Edmund Fitzgerald legend lives on, not least because of the famous song and the many lingering mysteries surrounding its demise, and also it lives on in the walls of Superior's Anchor Bar. In today's Wisconsin Life, producer Christian Knutson went to visit that bar and to hear the story behind its legendary life preserver.
Hi, Dean. In those days, it was much different than now. I came in right at towards the end of the shipping and the truckers, and never knew what was going to happen. They came in and they gambled and they worked hard and they played hard, and you know, it was very interesting in those days, a little more roughneck than nowadays.
Since 1977, Bean Pretty has been manager of the Anchor Bar and Grill. It's an unassuming yet venerable tavern nestled in the northwest corner of Wisconsin's northwesternmost city, Superior. Only blocks from a once bustling but now decrepit industrial waterfront, the Anchor has reinvented itself alongside the twin ports it serves. Its burgers are regional favorites, and a feature on the Food Network boosted an already steady stream of tourists.
A lot of people come up to Duluth just to visit, and now they'll come across the bridge to come visit us.
That's Adam Anderson. He co-owns the Anchor with his brother Aaron. Their parents purchased the tavern in 1977, and back then it was just a bar and served no food. Before too long, though, the Anchor became an unsalted shrine to nautical knickknacks.
I've always been a big junker, a big collector in auctions, rummage sales, and I started as dad going to some, and all of a sudden we started buying stuff at auctions, and then, you know, people started bringing in stuff.
It's not your everyday chain bar, so, you know, it's like a little museum.
The centerpiece of the Anchor's collection is the life buoy. Displayed behind glass and darkened by age, the orange ring bears two faded words stamped around its top. Edmund Fitzgerald.
A guy came in here once and he had it for sale. And the story is that he had bought it from a woman whose husband was on the Fitzgerald, and she was using it as a boat bumper on her pier, and she wanted to sell it.
The Fitzgerald, a Great Lakes ore boat, sank in a Lake Superior storm on November 10th, 1975. That was one day after it departed Superior. But this life ring wasn't from that final voyage.
Well, they got it. It would have been before it sunk. I don't know how long it was out of commission.
Pretty purchased the life ring about a dozen years ago.
I have been in antiques and stuff for years, and I've looked it over really good, and I just cannot see how it could be a fake. I'm sure it's a real one.
There are other life rings said to be from the Fitzgerald. The Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum in Paradise in the UP displays one, while the White River Light Station Museum in Whitehall, which is in Lower Michigan, has another. But they don't look the same. The former has white lettering, while the latter has black. The anchor's life rings letters, they're black.
I've talked to some Coast Guard guys, and they told me that there's only three in existence that they know of. And I haven't been able to verify it, but that's what I was told.
While the origins of the life ring are shrouded in memory, it and the stories still told about the Fitzgerald and its crew speak to the legend and its lasting draw at the anchor for locals and tourists alike.
I know people had relatives that were on the Fitzgerald and were lost that night. With the Fitzgerald, they kept it up by songs. They kept it up by books. It's a legend that they just didn't let die.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
As we've been talking about, 40 years ago this week, a November gale sank the Edmund Fitzgerald in Lake Superior. In the annals of shipwreck history, it's still one of the most mysterious and one of the most well-known shipwrecks.
Steve Ackerman is known as one of the weather guys. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic science at UW-Madison, where he recently gave a lecture about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Steve, welcome to Central Time.
I'm very glad to be talking with you, Veronica.
Well, just how accurate is that famous Gordon Lightfoot song about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald?
It's a very memorable storm, and it's pretty darn accurate in terms of documenting the events that went on that day. He's got a few things wrong here and there, but, you know, when one gives license to artists, it's hard to suggest that he should have, you know, been a little bit more accurate, if
now,
I can put it that way.
One thing you say he did get right is the line, Superior never gives up her dead. Why is that right?
That's kind of interesting. And that is usually when bodies die and drown and sink to the bottom, if the water is warm, there'll be biological activities that'll generate gases within the body, and then that causes them to float. But in cold waters like Superior, that kind of biological activity doesn't happen, and so the gas isn't generated. And so when bodies drown and sink to the bottom, they tend to stay down there.
And what did Gordon Lightfoot get wrong, or a little wrong, as you say?
I think a couple of things he got a little wrong, if we could put that way. In the song, there is a phrase there where it, I think the cook says, fellas, it's been good to know you, you know, implying that they kind of suspected that they would be sinking. But that really isn't the case. The indications are that while they knew they were in trouble, there was no real attempt to escape. There was no real SOS. So I don't think anybody really knew that they were going down, other than they were dealing with some difficult waters.
Oh, that's a shame. That's such a good line.
It is a good line. As you might know, he also changed one of his lines. He talked about in the original version of the song about the hatchways, implying that that was the problem for the sinking, and that's what the National Transportation and Safety Board originally concluded. But there is no real evidence that actually points that that was the particular problem. It seems to be one of two ways that people think that the ship took on water. And so he's changed that line so that he no longer talks about the hatchways.
Hmm. Well, when people ask you, a weather expert, why the Edmund Fitzgerald sank, you like to say weather. You know, it's true.
It's the weather, that's right.
You can't go wrong with that. But what can you tell us about that famous November storm?
So it's a tremendous storm to look at. You know, people say the gales of November. It is one of those storms. It's what we call a mid-latitude cyclone or an extratropical cyclone. It's a storm that has developed in the past and will continue to develop in the future. And sometimes they get really severe. They start just east of the Rockies in the panhandle of Oklahoma. And then as they develop and intensify, they head up towards the Great Lakes. this is not the only storm we've had that actually done this. We had the big Armistice Day of 1940. There was another big storm, pretty much just like this storm, that sunk the Edmund Fitzgerald in 1911 on Armistice Day, November 11th, 1911. And if folks were around this area in 1998, we had a storm that was very similar to the storm that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald. But again, in this case, the predictions were better, so there was more warning. Then there's obviously more safety things on the Great Lakes, and so nobody sank in that 98 storm.
Well, 1975, that was the year that the Edmund Fitzgerald went down. Why was it such a surprise to the crew and, I guess, to meteorologists at that time?
What happened was that it wasn't so much a surprise in the sense that the National Weather Service was forecasting that storm to move into the Great Lakes region. What they didn't forecast well was the intensity and the movement of the storm. And because of that, as the forecast was changed throughout the time period that the Fitzgerald was on the lake, they kind of modified their path. And then as the storm intensified, that actually turned out to be not the best approach. But they did it based on the National Weather Service forecast. If you remember, 1975, that was just the beginning of the satellite era.
Right.
It was just the beginning of weather radars. A lot has improved since then, but 40 years ago, there was still a lot of improvements to be made in weather forecasting.
So you're saying what they did, they modified their course, that might not have been the best choice. If you were calling
it
here from
forecast,
2015, what should they have done?
Well, I think they should have done what they did based on the forecast. What they did was they went further north along Lake Superior, along the Canadian border there to the north-northeast of Lake Superior in order to protect themselves from the buffeting winds that would be that were forecast. But because the storm developed and intensified more quickly than the National Weather Service had forecasted originally, what that meant was by the time they get up there and was heading towards Whitefish Bay, the winds had shifted around and were coming out of the northwest. And what that did was we had a nice big open water for the winds to blow over. And open water, strong winds, consistent winds leads to large waves. And that ended up putting them in trouble.
We're talking with UW-Madison professor Steve Ackerman, talking about the 40th anniversary of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which happened this week in the year 1975. And Steve, one thing that surprised me, you were talking about this at a public lecture. You said there was snow. This was a snowstorm. This wasn't just sort of a typical late-season thunderstorm. Is that also something that happens a lot with these late-season November gales?
Yeah, with these gale systems that we get, there are cold fronts and warm fronts that are associated with them. And a lot of times there's thunderstorms, but they also can be thunder snowstorms in the sense that they carry snow with them. And indeed, the Anderson, which was one of the ships that was going along with the Edmund Fitzgerald, reported a snow squall just before they lost sight of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
So it went down in the snow?
It went down as that squall line went by, yep. But it's probably not the snow that brought it down. It was probably associated with water being taken on by the boat, which would tend to lower the boat, and then as the boat would then hit a big wave, that would tend to slow the boat down as it tried to make its way over the wave. And the boat, of course, was carrying talconite pellets, which are like steel marbles, and that likely rolled to the bow of the boat, causing it to sink.
Can you describe a little bit what you think that Lake Superior might have been like during that sinking?
Oh, it would have been a body of water that I would not want to be on. So, we're talking about very strong winds, erratic winds, waves that were, 20 to 30 feet high, probably cold winds blowing as well. The winds were generally gusting at about 66 knots, which is, hurricane type of wind, although, again, hurricane winds, you need 65 knots of sustained winds. So, again, that's another thing that Gordon Lightfoot song mentioned about it. He talked about hurricane winds, but this was the peak wind, not the sustained wind.
And as we wrap up now, with today's satellite technology advances, if we had that exact same scenario today, the same ship, the same load of ore, the same storm, would the Fitzgerald have sunk today?
The forecast would have been much better. We saw that in 1998 when he had a very similar storm. And I think with those forecasts, they probably would not have changed their initial route. And as the forecast, again, because it got better, they might have, you know, sought shelter as opposed to trying making it to the locks.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Steve Ackerman, one of the weather guys and professor at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the storm that sank the Edmund Fitzgerald. The topic of obesity is almost constantly in the news, and it's a major talking point for everyone from First Lady Michelle Obama to celebrity chef Jamie Oliver.
Our next guest says the medical community is no exception when it comes to a cultural obsession with body weight. In a new article for Prevention Magazine, she says medical fat shaming, that is, fat shaming by healthcare providers, can lead to misdiagnosis and put patients at risk.
Harriet Brown joins us now. She's the author of Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. She's a professor of magazine journalism at Syracuse University. Harriet, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Veronica.
Well, first off, how would you describe what the term medical fat shaming means?
Well, what it basically means is you go to the doctor for whatever constellation of symptoms or for a well check or whatever, and basically the doctor's focus is only on your weight. And, you know, for the women that I talk to for this particular piece, although I've talked to a lot of people about this over the years, you know, everything ranging from a broken leg to a chronic cough was basically dismissed with advice to lose weight. Or, you know, worse than dismissed, I think, you know, doctors have said things to patients like, well, you're much too fat for me to set your leg. You know, you'll have to, like, lose weight, and then we'll just replace the whole joint. I mean, someone actually told me that once. So it's basically when your doctor looks at you and sees only your weight, makes a lot of assumptions about your behaviors and, you know, refuses to treat or mistreats or misdiagnoses you based on the fact that you're fat.
And you've said that doctors as a group are extremely fat phobic and that this is something that's well documented. So what is the evidence out there that doctors may tend to be fat phobic?
There's actually a very robust body of research on weight bias in among medical professionals. So doctors, med students, nurses, you know, dentists, I mean, every nutritionist, you name it, it's been studied. A lot of that studying has been done by researchers at Yale who are now at the University of Connecticut, you know, so they've been looking at this over a period of about 20 years, so it's not really new. And the lead researcher who's done a lot of work in this area, Rebecca Poole, told me when I first started talking to her about it, she said, you know, I've studied a lots of kinds of bias, and usually when you design a survey to sort of get at someone's level of bias around an issue, whatever it is, you know, you kind of have to design it so that it's not obvious what you're looking for, because most people don't want to cop to any kind of bias, right? Like, but she said, when I started working with doctors on the issue of weight bias, they would just come right out and say these things. There was no sense of even trying to be, you know, quote, politically correct about it. No, because they absolutely, you know, seem to feel that it's justified and warranted. And the numbers that she's come up with, you know, in terms of doctors who respond in fat-phobic ways to surveys is, you know, close to three-quarters of them.
Well, isn't it a doctor's job to get people to optimum health? And if that means saying, hey, you're overweight and having that tough conversation, does that make them fat phobic?
No, it doesn't. I'm glad you asked that. I think what the problem is that we conflate weight with health. So, you know, a person who goes to the doctor has, you know, excellent blood pressure, all the biomarkers, you know, blood glucose, everything is great, but their BMI puts them in the overweight range. You know, that's not a conversation about health, because by any measurable standard, that person is healthy. The flip side of that is, you know, let's say you have some kinds of issues. Let's say, and I've heard stories like this. One woman told me a story about her father. You know, most of the time this happens to women, but it certainly happens to men too. Her father, who had been, you know, quote, normal weight most of his life, suddenly gained a bunch of weight, went to the doctor, and, you know, all he could get from the doctor was, you know, you need to stop watching so much TV and exercise and eat well. And by the way, that kind of advice, A, is ineffective, and B, is often offered without any questions about what a person might or might not be eating or doing. You know, and it turned out that her father died from basically what was wrong with him, which was misdiagnosed as fat. So I think the issue is that we assume that weight is a proxy for health, but it's not. And, you know, there might be times when, I would argue this, that it's not true, but there might be times when weight loss for a particular person might help a health condition. But it's always true that there's lots of other things you can do, too. So I think as a way to start a conversation about health, it's a bad idea. And, of course, the other piece of that is we don't know how to make people thinner. So simply telling patients, go on a diet and lose weight, actually is setting them up to become fatter, because one of the side effects of dieting is weight gain over the long term. So it's kind of a lose-lose there.
We're talking about medical fat shaming right now with Harriet Brown. She's the author of the book Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. And we're talking about her new piece in Prevention Magazine that's up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And you profile, Harriet, in that piece, three women who are victims of what you call weight bias. Can you tell us some of their stories?
Right. So here's one. And here's one that kind of gets to your point about, isn't it a doctor's job to have the tough questions? So one woman who was 36 at the time told me, you know, she went to the doctor and her blood pressure had suddenly started spiking. And the doctor assumed it was because she was mildly obese on the BMI chart. It turned out that her blood pressure spike was a side effect of a new medication she was taking. You know, but because the doctor was so fixated on the weight, he or she, I don't know, you know, which it was, never asked any other questions, never probed any more deeply. And that's the real danger, you know, that if you assume it's about weight, you might not ask those questions. Reagan Chastain, a writer from L.A., told me, you know, she's been to the doctor with strep throat and been told, well, if you lose weight, your throat will heal itself. You know, and she weighs about 350 pounds. She's a large woman, but I don't think that you could really argue that that was good medicine. So another woman told me, you know, she slipped on the ice, broke her leg. The surgeon said, you know, just let it heal on its own. You're too fat. I can't do anything. Look, he said, look at yourself. You're so fat. So, you know, even if you were going to argue that weight loss should be part of a conversation between a doctor and a patient, that's probably not a super helpful way to go about it either.
It's interesting, those examples you just gave, they were all women patients. Is there any evidence that this is more often, when it happens, directed at women than men?
Absolutely. Someone did a study, and I can't recall offhand exactly who, but it was a study looking at when does sort of medical weight bias kick in, you know? And what they determined was that for women, being about 13, 14 pounds overweight, that's sort of when it kicked in. For men, it kicked in at a much higher weight. So in other words, a man who was in the overweight range on the BMI chart might not be the victim of medical fat shaming, whereas a woman is going to be held to a much lower weight standard, if you know what I mean.
We have
it happens a lot to women.
We have a comment here from Spencer on Facebook. He says, the reason doctors are so concerned with obesity is because it's the number one health problem. And I imagine maybe a lot of healthcare professionals would agree with that, that this is something that's contributive to a lot of other diseases, and therefore it's important to get on top of that right away. What do you say to that?
Well, I say a few things to that. And one is that, again, that's conflating weight with health. So let's try to separate those two things. We really don't know that. That's not proven. There are some actually, there's some very strong correlations between being overweight and mildly obese and living longer and doing better when you have certain diseases. So I would say that it's a very complicated relationship. It is not as straightforward as the commenter is saying or as doctors sort of often present it. So that's number one. And number two is, as I said before, we don't know how to make people thinner. Dieting leads to weight gain. You have a better chance of surviving metastatic lung cancer than you do of losing weight and keeping it off for three years or more. So, in fact, most people wind up heavier than when they started, and then they go through a process of weight cycling. You know, so you go on another diet, you lose weight, oh, then you gain it back, plus a little more, then you go on another diet. Well, it turns out that process of yo-yo dieting is actually far worse for your health than staying at a higher but stable weight. So it's certainly true that we have lots of health problems in this country, but it's and in the world, and but it's not necessarily true that they're caused by obesity, right? And if even if there is an association, we don't know what causes what. So, for example, there's a lot of research on the question of whether exposure to certain kinds of plastics and environmental pollutants, that causes obesity in laboratory animals. You know, is that part of what's making us? We are heavier than we were, for sure. We're also taller, by the way, but, you know, no one talks about that. So we're heavier than we were. We as a nation gained about 20 pounds on average between 1980 and 2000.
We're talking with Harriet Brown right now. She has a new piece in Prevention Magazine about medical fat shaming, and that's up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think, do you see this weight bias or medical fat shaming in the healthcare community? Have you experienced it, or is it the doctor's job to tell us to lose weight if they think we need to? Have you experienced this from the healthcare provider angle? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now about weight bias, or to put another way, medical fat shaming, with our guest Harriet Brown. She's the author of the book Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. And her piece about medical fat shaming is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you see this weight bias in the medical community? Have you experienced it? Are you a doctor? How do you handle issues of overweight or obesity? Call in at 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we've got a comment here from Jessica on Facebook who writes, I left my previous doctor and switched my kids because all she talked about was how overweight we were. Kids don't need to feel worse about themselves than they already do, and every adult should be looked at the same regardless of weight before the doctors decide weight is the cause of every problem. I found a doctor who truly cares and wants people to feel better and has never once called me overweight or blamed my weight. That's from Jessica. And Harriet, what do you say to Jessica there?
I would say that Jessica is a fantastic advocate for herself and her family, you know, and it's a hard thing. We tend to look at our doctors as if they know everything and as if they, you know, we have to trust them. But they're human beings like the rest of us, and so there are times when you have to advocate for yourself, and sometimes that means finding another doctor. So I applaud Jessica. I think, you know, It's great. I mean, one of the things people say is, well, if your doctor doesn't tell you that you're fat, you know, you might not know. You cannot be fat in this culture and not know that you're fat. You're subjected to so much, you know, stigma and discrimination, and you feel so much shame about it that, you know, believe me, people know what they weigh, and having it simply pointed out by someone you trust and look up to is not helpful.
We're going to go to a caller now. We've got Debbie on the line with us from Appleton. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. I've actually been fat shamed in the past, and I'm a nurse practitioner that works in a wound center. And many of our patients are people whose do carry excess weight, some quite a bit. And as a person who's been fat shamed and even fired my physician because of it, I do understand the sensitivity of the topic and how you approach it. And there are many of our patients who could have far less medical problems if they were able to lose some of their body weight. Now, with that being said, I think the first thing that people think of when someone tells them that they're overweight is that they need to be their ideal weight. And in reality, if I have a patient who's 440 pounds, and if they would get down to 350 or 380, or if they would lose some weight, they would see some improvement in the medical conditions that I have that they have associated.
Debbie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate you joining us today. And Harriet, what about that? What if it's not being told, you know, you're overweight, you got to lose weight, get off the couch, but more, you know, a little bit of weight loss would benefit you. Can that be handled in a way that is not fat shaming?
Well, two things to that. One is, I would say, how do you know that exactly? So, you know, how do you know that if someone is 440 pounds and they become 380 pounds or 400 pounds, that that's going to improve their health? You don't know that. That's really the reality. But what you do know is that there are ways to talk about health that might or might not lead to weight loss for some people, but will certainly improve health for everyone. So, for example, you know, you can talk to a patient about, let's talk about what you're eating. You know, what's your nutritional status like? You know, are you able to work physical activity into your daily life? You know, let's strategize about how you could do that. Those things we absolutely 100% know will make you healthier. And as I say, they may or may not lead to weight loss, but when you focus immediately and directly on the weight loss, it's a losing proposition, because the things that we do to deliberately lose weight do not work. And as I said before, often lead to the opposite effect.
Well, Debbie, thanks for the call. And we're going to go next to Christine in Milwaukee. Hi, Christine.
Hi.
What is your comment? Sure, go ahead.
Well, my comment was I had an undiagnosed thyroid condition for 15 years. I went to numerous doctors, more than six. And all of my complaints, which for a low thyroid, you're exhausted, you lose hair, you're tired, you can't lose weight. I was blamed. Well, you're fat. You must eat too much. And, you know, I would say, well, this is what I'm eating. Here's my journals. This is what I'm doing to exercise. And no one would believe me. Well, you're getting old. It couldn't be true. They would not believe me, because if you were doing those things, you wouldn't be fat, and you're fat. So, therefore, you're fat. I had an undiagnosed thyroid condition. I went until 47. Yeah. I could not have children. I was exhausted. I changed careers because someone looked at me, more than one doctor, and said, you're fat. I even had a doctor tell me, we all want those little pills that give us energy.
Well, Christine, I appreciate you calling and telling your story today. Thank you for that. And Harriet, it sounds a lot like the stories that you were sharing earlier, but I want to ask you, in this case, if you feel like you're in a situation where you might be on the road to being misdiagnosed, or you feel as though your concerns are not being addressed the way you'd like them to be addressed, what kinds of things can you do to advocate for yourself?
Well, it's a really great question, and I think one question that you can ask your doctor with respect, as you know, you want to be treated by respect and you treat them with respect, you could say, if I was thin, what would your response be to whatever your presenting problem was, you know? And if that doctor said, well, you know, we might look into your thyroid levels, then, you know, you can say, I would like my thyroid levels checked. I mean, it's a hard thing to do because you're speaking to an authority figure, but that's the kind of thing you have to do. If I was thin, how would you treat me differently? What would you do with a patient who was thin? Ultimately, you know, I feel terrible for this caller who says she went to more than six doctors. I believe her because I've heard so many stories like this. You keep looking until you find someone who can look at you, your health, and not just see the number on the scale.
Harriet, do you see this at all changing the consciousness about the way that we view weight in our society? I mean, I think about the term fat shaming. That's a new term. That wasn't around, I think, even 5 years ago. So do you see things maybe shifting and just even the way we think about weight?
I think this is the first baby step. So yes, I do see a little bit of change, but nothing significant, because and I think that sort of level of change that you're talking about, even acknowledging that there is such a thing as fat shaming, has come about because the talk about obesity just, like, comes at us everywhere and all the time. As you said, you know, everyone from Michelle Obama to Jamie Oliver to, like, you know, your friends and family and everyone. So I think we have a way to go with this, and I think this kind of change happens very slowly. But, yeah, I'm a little bit hopeful. How about you?
Well, we'll have to see what happens. I'm curious about the medical profession. In general, you talked about what patients can do. What about if you're in the medical profession and you want to urge patients to be healthy, you want to urge them to exercise, to look at their nutrition, or you don't want to be seen as someone who has weight bias or is fat phobic? What would you tell the medical profession, those who are listening right now?
What a great question. I would say, you know, think about health rather than weight. Think about how would you treat, you know, sort of check your own biases. We all have biases. You know, you can't be human and not have them. So think about it. Are you unconsciously thinking about or treating a fat patient differently than a thin patient? You know, I think you just have to be aware. And I think educate yourself on the research that fat is not proven to be a cause of any disease, and in some cases it's actually associated with better health. And obviously that's different for every individual person. So in the ideal world, doctors would look at us each as an individual and not just sort of pigeonhole us.
And do you see this as something that's on the radar of the healthcare industry, healthcare providers right now? Are they thinking about this?
No. No, they're not. I have I have colleagues who work in medical schools, and they tell me it's absolutely, you know, there's a lot of pushback, in fact, against this idea. So I don't know. I don't know what will happen.
Well, Harriet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
That was Harriet Brown, author of the book Body of Truth, How Science, History, and Culture Drive Our Obsession with Weight and What We Can Do About It. Her piece about medical fat shaming is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.